the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell. In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, host Gene Pell talks with retired U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Wilma L. Vaught, president of the Women in Military Service for America Memorial Foundation.
You come out of a small town in Illinois, and I always like to begin these by asking my guests what the early influences were on their life and how they managed to carry through into their later careers.
I felt it was a significant factor in my career that I came from a rural community, went to a small school, very small school. My class in high school, my graduating class, was the largest class ever to graduate, and there were 24 of us, 12 boys, 12 girls. And we got personal attention from the teachers. They weren't just teachers and people there. They were our friends. They came to our parties. They were models for us. They encouraged us. They helped us. And that was, I just feel I owe so much to that community and to that school and to the teachers that were that I was fortunate enough to have through that period of time.
Parental influence?
What?
Your parental influence? Did your parents encourage you in any particular direction?
My parents always encouraged me to believe that I could do whatever I was capable of doing. I spent a lot of time, because I was a child of World War II when my father couldn't get any help, and so I worked a lot on the farm with my father. So I spent a good share of my growing up period of time working in the company of men. And that helped me immensely when I went into the military service. And at that time, women were a very small segment. I think we were 0.7% of the number of people in the service. So that's not a critical mass by any means. And most of the time, I was one of just a handful of women wherever I happened to be stationed.
What led you to the Air Force in the first place?
I went in the Air Force after I received a recruiting letter from the Army indicating that they had a program giving direct commissions to women and you could manage and supervise. And I lived about halfway between Fort Benjamin Harrison at Indianapolis, Indiana, and Chanute Air Force Base at Rantoul, Illinois. And I talked to a couple of neighbor fellows who had served in the Army and the Air Force. And I asked them which way they thought I should go. And they told me they thought that my opportunities would be greater in the Air Force than the Army, because the majority of positions in the Army were artillery, armored, and artillery, and I wouldn't qualify to be in any of those. Those are the combat arms. Where with the Air Force, you were sending off a handful of people in a plane as the offensive force, and so there were all kinds of jobs that were available to women that I would have a greater opportunity to go overseas with the Air Force, so I went with the Air Force.
What was the environment like when you got in terms of the acceptance of women at that time?
There was never a question about acceptance at any of the places I went. In fact, I always considered kind of a plus the fact that we were sort of a novelty. You were just one of a handful of people, and so you stood out. So if you did well, you got more recognition than you probably deserved, because you were one among many. And I always felt it was a plus as opposed to being a negative factor in my life.
Well, you rose to the rank of a star as a general and the first woman to achieve that, as I recall.
No, I was not the first woman. I was one of the first 20.
Out of all the positions you held, and you had held a lot of them in a lot of different places, what was the most satisfying experience you had as a career?
The assignment that I had that I learned the most in that had such tremendous meaning to me was when I was a captain. I was the management analysis officer for the bomb wing, and that was when the bomb wing deployed to Guam in the B-52 bombing of Vietnam. And to be a part of something that big, and I worked directly for the wing commander, analyzing maintenance and bombing activity and operational activity. I had a commander that I learned so very much from. I think of him so often that I do yet today. That I think of the lessons I learned from him, and particularly with respect to writing, because he was a skilled writer who taught you to make every word count, and that has helped me probably more than anything else in my career. The second thing, unquestionably, was being a commander of the U.S. Military Entrance Processing Command with some 3,300 people, and it extended from Guam to Alaska to Maine to Puerto Rico and all places in between. And that was a challenging thing to be a commander of an organization like that.
Well, after you retired, you took on another very big challenge, which a lot of people didn't think could be accomplished, which was raising the money to build a memorial to American women in military service. But you did it, and it stands at the entrance to Arlington National Cemetery. I've been there, as a matter of fact. So that had to have been a gratifying experience, and you're still involved in that, are you not?
I am still in charge of that project and the operation of the memorial and the functioning of the foundation staff. That, in my mind, will always be probably the best thing I've ever done. And you certainly put it correctly when you mentioned raising the money to do it, because one of the big lessons you learn when you're in a project like that, it doesn't make any difference how great the cause is, or how wonderful the site, or how beautiful the design of what you're going to do. If you don't get the money, it is never going to happen. And that was always the biggest challenge, was getting the money to do it. And I always felt if we could get the money, everything else would fall into place. And that's the way it went. When we finally got the money together, we were able to resolve the design issues and move forward. And the joy and the pride that memorial has given, particularly the women who served in World War II in Korea, is just can't be described. They come and see that memorial, magnificent that it is, and they never dreamed that they would ever be recognized for what they did with something as magnificent as this. Tears come to their eyes, and you can't help but feel proud to have been a part of creating this.
Well, I know that one of your goals was not only to raise the money, but to achieve the design and the construction and the opening in order that those very women, particularly from the Second World War, who were still alive, would have a chance to go there and see this tribute to them.
Well, that's certainly true. And as we went through the years of getting the money and doing the other things we had to do to bring this thing to fruition, always in my mind was planning the dedication, because I wanted to do a dedication that for these women it would be the greatest moment in their life. And I can't just tell you how many letters and notes and comments that I've had for women saying precisely that. That was the greatest thing of my life, was to come there and be there for that dedication. Because we pulled out all the stops. We did an unforgettable series of events for the dedication, and tried to involved directly, as many people, so that they could truly feel, this is my memorial. I am a part of this. And I think we succeeded in that.
Finally, get you out of here with this. What would you say to a young woman today who came to you and asked, should I consider a career in not just the Air Force, but the Armed Forces of the United States?
I would certainly recommend a career in the Armed Forces to anyone, both male and female, and particularly to young people, because being in the military, even 2 or 3 years, you come out a different person than when you went in, because you have had to associate with people that are unlike other people you might never have run into in your life. You may have to go to places you never will go to again in your life, and that will expand your knowledge of the world. You will be challenged to take a leadership position in doing a job that perhaps you thought you would never be able to do. And so you learn so much that when you come out, you're not the same person as when you went in. And you have gained so much. You've learned discipline. You have learned how to work with people. You have learned how to lead. And I don't know any place that you can get the same experience that you can get in the armed services. And further, we talk a lot about the bond that's formed of people who serve in the military. And that is so very, very true, because it's one of those things you can't describe until you've been there and you've done that. To the person who's been in the military, you meet another military person, doesn't matter what era, what service, you share something. You share an experience that those who've never done it never have the opportunity to know about.
In our next segment of Veterans Chronicles, host Gene Pell discusses the accomplishments of Major Nicole Malachowski of the United States Air Force, the first woman pilot to fly as part of the Thunderbirds.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are
through your MP3 player.
Log on to www.radioamerica.org
and click on the podcasting icon.
Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.
You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes.
The Veterans Chronicles podcast.
Now online
at radioamerica.org.
Host Gene Pell now talks with Major Nicole Malachowski of the United States Air Force about her incredible experience as a fighter pilot.
Most people graduate from high school and don't have a clue as to what they're going to do, and I might say the same thing is true a lot of college graduates. So from the age of 5, you decided you were going to fly and that you were going to be a fighter pilot.
Yes,
how did that come about?
Well, I often point to, I think, two things. The first is that I came from a very patriotic, your average middle-class American family. I remember being 3, 4, 5 years old, literally, and always going to the Veterans Day parades. My grandfather, the paternal grandfather, had been a Korean War veteran. He was very active in those kinds of veterans events, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, American Legion, things like that. And so I always watched the parade, and as a kid, I loved the teamwork and the people marching together and the beautiful uniforms. And so I grew up in a culture and a family where I knew that serving your country by wearing your nation's uniform was accepted. It was noble. It was honorable. It was an okay thing to do. It wasn't overtly spoken. It was just something I knew because it was part of my life. And then the thing that I think just solidified it was I was about 5 years old when my parents took me to an air show. And I thought the airplanes were neat until the F-4 Phantom flew by, which, as you know, was a workhorse fighter aircraft during the Vietnam War. And it was loud and it was fast. And you could smell the fuel as it went by. And, you know, your whole chest and your whole body shook when it flew by. And I'm like, what more could a little girl want? I mean, I fell in love with the thing. I always say the F-4 Phantom was my first love. And I looked at my dad in the eye that day and I said, I'm going to be an Air Force fighter pilot. and my dad said, you're going to be a great Air Force fighter pilot. I guarantee you, had he said anything else, I would not be sitting here talking to you today. So the importance of being raised in a culture that honors public service, solidified by a family who just said, yes, you can be anything you want, those two things together put me on that path.
Well, it's interesting from this perspective that we hadn't really recovered from Vietnam yet at that point when you were about 5 years old. And
right.
There were an awful lot of people in the country who did not think it was a noble calling and felt quite the opposite, as a matter of fact. But that was never a part of your family.
It wasn't a part of my family. My father had been drafted into the Army during Vietnam. He stayed stateside, and he served 2 years doing administration. So his job was to type up the orders to send soldiers over to Vietnam and then to receive them back in. And, you know, he's told stories about friends that he typed up orders for that never came back. And again, my grandfather having been a Korean War vet, my mom's father also served in the Navy during World War II, my other grandfather. So public service is something that's honored in my family and always has been. And I think that's why, regardless of how you serve, as long as you're serving something bigger than yourself, it was always accepted.
Having made this decision at this early age, very early age,
yes.
How did you then go about preparing to fulfill your dream?
Well, I think, again, I needed to point back to my parents. My parents, I would always ask rhetorical questions like, so you're going to be a fighter pilot. What does one have to do to become a fighter pilot? And, you know, through elementary school and junior high, that's where I realized you need to have good grades. You know, you have to be a commissioned officer. Well, how do I become a commissioned officer? So that's when I learned about the Air Force Academy. I joined an organization called the Civil Air Patrol when I was 12 years old, where I started taking my very first flying lessons. I started flying when I was 12, and I joined, you know, Air Force Junior ROTC in high school. So just constantly staying focused and trying to choose organizations that would further my goal. I think the important thing is that I somehow managed, and I don't really have an answer for this, to stay focused, especially through those hard years of, you know, junior high and high school, which is difficult for a lot of kids. Again, I give a lot of credit to my parents. They always taught me to choose my friends very, very wisely. And so I often talk to kids these days. They say, what's the secret to success? Like, there's some recipe. And my answer is always surround yourself with positive people. I really believe if you can do that, you can do anything. And I think that that's the one thing I point to. I have always just been my own team coach, and I try to pick my own team players, if that makes sense. So Civil Air Patrol, Air Force, Junior ROTC, learning what was required to get in the Air Force Academy. So prioritizing getting good grades, prioritizing community service type events. When I was 12 years old, no, make that probably 13, I wrote to the Air Force Academy admissions office, and I said, I want to go to the Air Force Academy because I'm going to be a fighter pilot. Now, remember, women still couldn't be fighter pilots at this time, but I didn't care. I was going to be a fighter pilot, and I was going to go to the Air Force Academy. And this gentleman wrote back, and he's like, hey, you're really young, but it was a really gracious letter. Here's what the application looks like. Here's all of our stuff as if you're going to be a cadet. Enjoy. Well, I would write to him every year. And then, you know, to know that I showed up there, you know, and he had actually left like the year before I became a cadet, but people in the admissions office knew who I was when I showed up when I was 17. They're like, you're that Ellingwood kid from Las Vegas. I'm like, yes, I am. So
the Navy has some pretty good fighter pilots. Do you ever give any thought to the Navy?
I did give thoughts to the Navy. Both of my grandfathers served in the Navy. My paternal grandfather eventually got commissioned into the Army as an officer. So actually, me choosing the Air Force was a very different path for the service, you know, that had come from my family. I did. I got a four-year Naval ROTC scholarship, and I also got accepted to the Naval Academy. So I was very lucky to be able to be afforded that choice and that opportunity. And I will tell you, having been out on an aircraft carrier during Operation Iraqi Freedom as a guest of the men and women of the USS Harry Truman, I got nothing but respect for naval aviators. I know what they do in the air because we work together on missions, but to see carrier operations, that is something that you cannot understand unless you're on the deck watching that dynamic, professional puzzle that they make look so smooth.
Coming up, Malachowski describes her first experience as a fighter pilot.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center. an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Now, back to Major Nicole Malachowski of the United States Air Force with our host, Gene Powell.
When did you get your first crack at the Strike Eagle?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I graduated pilot training in December of 1997 and went straight to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in North Carolina, which is where we spent about 10 months learning how to fly the F-15E. And I remember when I showed up, that was the first time I realized really that some people, the older generation that had been flying Strike Eagles, so the instructors were kind of like, oh, there's a gal here. And there had been three women who had flown the Strike Eagle before me. Jeannie Flynn, the first woman fighter pilot, Don Dunlap, and another gal by the name of Carrie Kane, all fabulous women that I'm still in touch with today. My first instructor pilot was a gentleman, call sign Hoover, and his last name was Quinn, and he was fabulous. You know, he just wanted me to be the best F-15E fighter pilot I could be. He put as much effort into me as I could have possibly hoped for. So, you know, there was always that inquisitive look that you could see in the back of their minds. They're kind of going, God, this is kind of weird to have this short gal flying fighters, but whatever, my job's to teach her. And they did that. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was able to graduate and go off to my first fighter squadron.
Mm-hmm. And what about joining the first squadron?
Well, when I got to my first squadron, now this is kind of an interesting story, actually. There were eight of us that graduated from Seymour Johnson that went off to RAF Lakenheath in the United Kingdom, just outside of Cambridge. What a wonderful thing. 23 years old, heading overseas, my first fighter squadron. We show up and, like, the squadron's pretty much, like, deploying, and we don't know what for. We're kind of like, where's everybody going? And Operation Northern Watch was in full effect, and eventually some people were deploying for what would become Operation Allied Force over Kosovo. But at the time, we didn't know. And so the flying was very, very sparse because there weren't a lot of jets there. People were coming and going. We came into a squadron that really wasn't complete because they were out there doing their real mission around the world. And we didn't fly for some time. And they were like, wow, if these guys don't fly within, like, the next, you know, like, week or two, we have to send them back through another complete 10-month requalification course. And I remember all of us just looking at each other going, geez, you know, we made it through the first time. Lord help us if we have to go through that again. Luckily, they recognized that they fixed it. And next thing you know, literally, we're deploying to fly over Kosovo. We were a generation that showed up and as lieutenants went and did that. The weapons systems officers in the class, the backseaters, got to fly in Operation Allied Force. So fresh out of the chute. And remember, they went to the deployed location, and that was the first time they had met some of their squadron mates because we came on board when some were gone. And I ended up flying, like, the day after they ceased official hostilities, and they changed it to Operation Deliberate Forge. And my very first flight was over Montenegro, actually. And in the back seat, because I was new, it was my first, like, combat sortie. I was so new and so young. It was nighttime. I was just happy to, like, not lose sight of my flight lead, get my gear up. And lucky for me, they put the squadron commander in my back seat. So he took good care of me and has been a mentor to me to this day, a guy by the name of Colonel Summonsby. So that was the arrival into my first fighter squadron.
Next, Malachowski explains her experience as being a woman in an overwhelmingly male-dominated work environment.
I have to admit there were some who were not very welcoming at first. Very few that were overt about it. It took me a little while to kind of find my place socially. And the way I found my place socially, which took me probably close to a year, I'll be honest, is by doing the one thing my dad told me to do when I would call him upset that the guys all went out to have a beer night, no one invited me, or, you know, and you have to remember, this is a young 23-year-old mind at work, was to do what my dad told me. He said, just fly the plane. And by just flying the plane and learning as much as I could and putting as much effort into every sortie, they come around, because they're fighter pilots too. They just want to know that you can do your job and that they can trust you like they trust their brothers, that you're going to be a good wingman. And that was my job, to just fly the plane and be the best wingman that I could be. And it goes back to what I'm saying is, these gentlemen, my brothers, they're my family. And while socially it was maybe a little bit of an adaptation at first, during that first year, they never treated me differently in a brief. They never scheduled me differently. They never taught me differently. They gave me the same quality of instruction. And some of the instructors, I think, really went out of their way to make me feel welcome, but they were an older, believe it or not, ironically, an older generation, lieutenant colonels, et cetera. And I could rattle all their names off because they're still friends of mine today. What I can tell you is, by just flying the plane, just being the best wingman I could be, that they came around socially, and with 100% accuracy. Any people that gave me any gruff, which is fine, that's what fighter pilots do, but any of them that had kind of gone, you know, we don't want a gal in the squadron, every single one of them to this day has come up, now that they're men, they're not boys, you know what I'm saying? They're men, they're married, they have daughters. They have all apologized, some with those words, I'm sorry, and some in different ways by knocking on my door with a case of beer and saying, here I am. And that is great. That is good by me. I never wasted much thought on it, but it makes me feel really good that they came around. And I think that most of them, honestly, are like, I have a daughter now, and I want you to be her role model. And I'll tell you, there's nothing more humbling than to have a guy who maybe, you know, maybe we started on a little bit of a bad foot, but now we're as tight as ever. And I love my brothers in the Strike Eagle community, and I miss them very much right now.
What about off to Iraq?
Oh, this was interesting. So I had such a blessed career. I went ops to ops from Laken Heath to Seymour Johnson. I flew two operational back-to-back fighter squadrons, which is very lucky and very unique. Why did I have that opportunity? Because Colonel Summonsby seized it for me, because he believed in me. Okay? He was my squadron commander and got that assignment. Loved being in my second fighter squadron. Flew September 12th, 2001, over World Trade Center. I'll never forget that. Never forget flying over the Pentagon. Headed back to Laken Heath for a third operational assignment before I wasn't even a middle-aged captain, just unheard of. Luck and timing. I became a flight commander, and wouldn't you know it, you know, we get ready to deploy to Iraq, and I got to lead peers to battle, and that is like the highest honor that I've ever had. I led in peacetime, you know, I'd been chiefs of different shops, and I'd been a flight commander in peacetime, but to look at your guys and get them together, I was a sea flight commander, and get these eight guys together, most of them lieutenants, and you're a captain, and you look at them, you're like, we're going, are you ready, what do you need, here's some last minute stuff. Talking to their spouses, which is an interesting perspective, because I'm an Air Force spouse too, I'm an Air Force wife, I'm very proud to be one. And we were taking off at 2 in the morning out of RAF Laken Heath to fly to our deployed location in the Middle East. And I was to lead the second cell of 8 F-15Es. So there were 16 total going. And our squadron commander, a guy by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Dan Debris, how I got so lucky with such great squadron commanders, I have no idea. He's the finest leader I've ever worked for in the Air Force. He was leading the first cell, and we were a little bit behind them. And we took off, and the tankers took off in front of us. It was nighttime. All the kids and families are waving goodbye, and there's tears, and, you know, of joy and tears of sadness. And my husband was there, and the commander's jet broke on the runway. And he could have picked anybody, and he picked me, and I led 15 F-16s from RAF Lake and Heath to our deployed location, and we got there, and I just thought, what an amazing thing. I'll tell you what, though, at 2 in the morning, you know, you'd sat in the Brave, you're ready to fly your jet, part of the formation, when he Heisman's to you, hey, Fifi, you got it. All of a sudden, the cockpit just goes crazy. I got paperwork everywhere. I'm like, oh, my God, what'd they say in the brief again? But anytime you key the mic, you sound calm and cool. There can be all sorts of helmet fires going on in your head, but you have to key the mic and sound cool. So that's how I ended up getting to Iraq. So many stories there. What did I learn from Iraq? Man. Those soldiers and Marines on the ground are my heroes. You're talking on the radio to somebody who's in a firefight, and they're asking for your help. You're trying to get over there. Maybe you're not on site yet, and then the radio goes dead. That changes your life forever. You're doing convoy escort. You're escorting a convoy, which these days are oftentimes led by Air Force airmen, which most people don't know, leading these convoys from the south to the north. And all of a sudden, that vehicle's gone. It wasn't even that you could help. It was a buried, improvised explosive device. And you're just like, it changes you forever. It gave me, first of all, I always respected the other services and the people on the ground, but it is a whole new level. Because you don't care about the policy of why the United States is over there. You don't really care that you're the Air Force fighter pilot, you're supposed to be the hot shot up there or whatever, you know, bringing my bombs, this and that. Man, I'll tell you what, it's that there are Americans down there on that ground, and it becomes very personal. At least I felt very, it might even be some kind of maternal instinct or something. There is a deep, deep feeling when that American voice comes on. It is no longer about anything but America. And I want that soldier and Marine to get home to his wife and his kids in one piece, you know? So it affects you. And the second thing I learned was perspective. I was this 30-year-old fighter pilot running around. I'm a tough, confident gal. Look at me, my third fighter squadron. You know, I'd be mad if someone, you know, cut me off in traffic, or if, you know, I wasn't getting customer service at some who knows store or whatever, and I think, gosh, that person, I don't live like that anymore. War took a lot of that pressure and stress off my shoulders, so I think that's a benefit. I have perspective. It takes a lot these days to get me fired up or upset. I just don't sweat the small stuff anymore.
Well, let's move to the Thunderbirds.
Oh, my.
First woman to fly with them. That had to be obviously an honor to have been selected.
Absolutely.
But an exhilarating prospect when you learned that you were going to do it. And has it met your expectations?
It exceeded any expectations I had. I don't know that what those expectations really necessarily were going into it. I need to tell you, or I feel like I need to tell you, that when I applied for the Thunderbirds, I had no idea they hadn't had a woman pilot. It didn't even occur to me. I mean, women had been flying fighters for so many years. Jeannie Flynn, you know, there had been women in combat before I even had my first sortie in a Strike Eagle. So it didn't even occur to me. And I will tell you that I was blissfully naive. Within the Air Force, it was generally celebrated. I think people were proud. And outside in the media, it turned into just this frenzy. For about the first 8 months, I had never dealt with the media. I'd always been part of the team. It was very difficult to be highlighted. One, because it makes you personally uncomfortable. But professionally, I cared very much about bonding. I had just shown up on the team. I need to bond with these guys. You know what I'm saying? We're going to be flying 3 feet away from each other, 500 miles an hour, 300 feet off the ground. I need some room and some time to gain and garner their trust, and vice versa. So I had to work really hard to get over the shock and to really prioritize my efforts and my time. The leadership in the Air Force did a great job of trying to manage that for me and the media attention, and I will tell you that I really was given 100% carte blanche to say no to anything media-wise. I was absolutely unprepared for that. I still look back and think, you've got to be kidding me. In 2 years, I did over 1,000 media interviews. So that is not what a fighter pilot expects. I'm just a fighter pilot. I've been a fighter pilot in an ALO, and I was just going to go do this Thunderbird thing. And the reason why is because I saw what we were doing in Iraq, and I was getting frustrated with what I saw on TV. And the only opportunity for a senior captain in the Air Force who's not a public affairs officer by trade to be able to share the Air Force story that I could see was the Thunderbirds. And I knew what my friends were doing over there. And when I flew in Iraq, that in my third squadron, some of those guys I was talking to on the ground were my JTACs in Korea. We went from this being on the Korean Peninsula to, no joke, a combat zone. And I just felt, I really did feel compelled. And that's it. That was my intention. And I got picked up, and I had no, there's no way to prepare for what happened. It just cracks me up. I'll tell you, honor and a privilege of a lifetime.
In our upcoming Profiles in Valor episode, American Veterans Center Director Tim Holbert talks with First Sergeant Donnie Brazil, United States Marine Corps retired. A Marine for 23 years, Brazil is a recipient of the Bronze Star with Valor for actions during Operation Iraqi Freedom.